Hello and welcome to another episode of Everything is Canon, the Cinemas Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Duncan. However you may have found your way here, thanks so much for tuning in. On this podcast, we invite authors from all genres onto the show to discuss their latest books and novels, as well as just about anything else that comes to mind. If you want to reach me, there are several ways to do so, but the best way is to email me at steve@cinelinks.com, or you can always find me on Twitter at stevedunk5 or at everythingcanon. Today in the show, I'm talking to Daniel Jose Older all about his latest Star Wars book and entry into Wave 2 of the High Republic era, his excellent middle grade book, Race to Crash Point Tower. Set just before the disastrous events of Cavan Scott's The Rising Storm, Daniel's book takes place mostly on the planet Valo and follows Jedi Padawan Ram Jamaran and a top-to-bottom fun cast composed mostly of younger characters to create not only an exciting, fast-paced adventure, but a genuine look at how these young Jedi and their friends deal with adversity, relationships, and danger. We talk about dogs, of course, some current hot-button issues in publishing, what exactly is a Star Wars architect, lots of the High Republic, Race to Crash Point Tower, and much, much more. While this is a mostly spoiler-free discussion, the odd minor detail may slip out, so if you haven't read the book and don't wish to be spoiled at all, better stop listening now, but definitely double back once you've read it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the show. As always, around these parts, we encourage supporting authors and stories that affirm the lives of people other than ourselves. Each time we either engage in a conversation, whether it be online or face-to-face, or each time we participate in the market with our purchasing choices. This, of course, should be done all year long. Just because Pride Month is coming to an end on the Gregorian calendar doesn't mean we should stop being allies to the community. So since July is a month, doesn't have a predominant social media holiday that I'm aware of. And although July 30th is International Friendship Day, which is lovely, let's keep the good times rolling and continue to support our friends in the LGBTQIA plus community any which way you can. Daniel Jose Older is the New York Times bestselling author of the upcoming YA fantasy novel, Bal and Dagger, book one of the Outlaw Saints series, the sci-fi adventure Flood City as well. His other books include the historical fantasy series, Dactyl Hill Squad, the Book of Lost Saints, like I just said, the Bone Street Rumba urban fantasy series, and the young adult series, Shadow Shaper Cipher, including Shadow Shaper, which was named one of the best fantasy books of all time by Time Magazine. He won the International Latino Book Award and has been nominated for the Kirkus Prize, the World Fantasy Award, the Andre Norton Award, the Locus, and the Myopic Award. He also co-wrote the upcoming graphic novel, Death's Day. It's safe to say, after all that, he's probably best known for his contributions to the Star Wars universe, which includes being a lead story architect, we'll ask him what that means, for Star Wars The High Republic, the monthly comic series The High Republic Adventures, a couple of short stories, and Star Wars Last Shot, which I'm a huge fan of. Speaking of which, he's specifically here, though, to talk about his new Star Wars middle grade book, Race to Crash Point Tower, which is part of Phase 1 2.0, I think, I'm not sure what we're calling it, of the High Republic Initiative. And if you don't know what that is, then you've managed to steer clear of any and all things Star Wars publishing, and I applaud your ability to do so. You're able to disconnect from the world that much, then you're doing something I can't do. I'm very happy he's here. I've actually wanted to talk to him for a long time. Mostly about his dogs, though, because I love a good Twitter dog account, because I have two myself. So please welcome Daniel Jose Older. Hi, Daniel.
Hey.
Cheer, applause. Yeah. It's so funny because I used to write for the force.net, right? And and we never talked to him the whole time I was there. It doesn't make any sense. I don't know. It's just the way it goes. But I'm glad you're here now. Certainly better late than never.
Yeah.
So I guess you're going to stick it out with the Star Wars stuff, eh? Is that the idea?
I'm having fun. That's all. I'm just having a good time. Like, when I stop having fun, that might be the last thing to me.
Tough. How bad would things have to get, eh? Like, what is a lead story architect?
That's a great question. I wish someone would tell me.
Is it on your card? Did you put it on like a business card yet or no?
I should. It sounds so cool. I immediately put it on my bio as soon as it became true.
It is very cool,
It's just so cool. I think of it mostly in terms of the meta beats of a story.
Right? Yeah.
Because there's two parts to the job of the High Republic, of writing the High Republic. There's the books and the comics and the things that we do as individuals. And then there are the big beats of the larger story, the galactic history that we're telling as a team. And that's really where the architecture part comes in. So it's much like if you think about George R. R. Martin's Gardener versus Architect, let me turn that off, formulation around like process for writing, you know, the architects being the ones that meticulously, go through an outline and have the structure that they then flesh out. and the gardeners being the ones who plant seeds and kind of let things grow. You know, like the architecture part of the High Republic for us, because it's a team project, really is like creating those larger beats and the larger kind of essence, you know, the harder to describe things that are part of this era, which includes character development. But a lot of that happens obviously on the page and includes kind of the larger arcs of the characters and the Jedi Order itself. All of that really falls under the kind of hat of architecture.
See, this is different even for you because, you know, you're on the other side of the table now in a way, because in a way you're the IP now. Because as mm-hmm. most people know, and if they don't know, Star Wars Lucasfilm has a story group, which are the architects, right. I guess, of the whole shebang, right? Not just the High Republic, but the whole thing. So in a way, you're on that side of the table now, right? Like you're kind of the story group for this particular era anyways.
We still, story group, story group.
So of course. No, idea. Yeah, you're not employed necessarily, right, by Lucasfilm, but, right.
But no, we do function like a mini story group.
Right, yeah. For sure. And so how has that changed?
Yeah, which is
Like there's the obvious ways that it's changed, right? Because you're getting to create, you know, all this new great shit for Star Wars, right? Whereas before you were just playing in the sandbox. 100%. Like you did create some beats and characters for, you know, Last Shot and stuff like that and some other stuff you've done, but this is different, right? Like this is something else.
Yeah. And that's really the difference too. And just in writing the two different eras is that, you know, like you're hard pressed to come up with a new Jedi in the original trilogy era, right? Or even the prequel trilogy era, who's not about to die, you know?
Yeah.
That's a reality that you have to, I don't think work around is the right term because it sounds like you know it's like a big.
Well, you have to be accountable. It's accountability, right? Yeah,
accountability is a perfect way to do it, and that's fun, and that has its own complications and its own gifts and everything else. But it's very, very different than what you say, which is writing. We are really like the sandbox, right? Creating the whole sandbox, and it's in conversation with the Star Wars that we know and love. But that's very different than being enmeshed in the middle of, right?
Yeah. We'll talk about, like, we'll get into a bit more in a bit here, but one of the great things I really like about, and I don't, you know, it's arbitrary in a way, but having it set 300, you know, years before anything recognizable necessarily it gives you such a great buffer. You're a clear generation away from anything we knew before the High Republic, right?
That we meet is
that's doomed. Right. So like that gives you so much flexibility, doesn't it? And like talks about what we just said about having to account for people's whereabouts. You can just say they died of natural age. You don't have to like cite any event or anything, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's fun. And that transforms it, but it also ups the stakes in a way because there's no Order 66, but we don't know what there is, right?
Right. Well, you get to make it up. You make up your own Order 66, whatever that is. And in the case of Phase One, it was, you know, the big, you know, cataclysmic event.
Right.
Are we calling this Phase One Part Two? What are we calling the second sort of?
This is Wave Two.
Wave Two. Okay. Yeah. So Wave. Right. I'm very happy, by the way, with the amount of stuff we're getting in each phase.
It looks too, man. As a fan and a writer,
I'm right? Sure. Yeah, because it's you know, if Phase One had just been that first wave,
that wouldn't be enough.
Which was right, but now we've got this thing can get away from us. I mean, like in 3 years, are we going to have 10 phases or 18 waves? And I don't know. We'll see. we'll talk about Wave Two in a bit here, and there's some big events in Wave Two, but we'll talk about what we're allowed to talk about, anyways. Uh-huh. But I've got you here, and because I'm such a fan of you as a human, as a humanitarian, as a person, I just want to we got to talk about some other stuff. Dogs. you have such a. I'm a dog guy too, right? I have two rescues. I've always rescued.
Oh, I have two rescues as well.
Yes, I know that because I love anyone that puts their dogs as much on Twitter as much as you do. I'm a fan of because I don't have kids. I'm not having kids. These are my kids, my life.
So. Oh, I understand.
Yeah, and do you have kids? I don't think you have kids. Do you?
No comment.
Okay, understood.
I will say this: I didn't have kids when I wrote Last Shot. Which I'm very happy to be. That's often a surprise to people because they're like, you got that dad thing just right.
Right.
That's because I'm a good writer, not because I'm a dad.
Right, yeah. A good writer can write anything, yeah. So I'm a huge fan of dogs. I was an investigator actually for the SPCA in a former life. So
Whoa, that's fascinating.
Did that for years actually before. So I've got some stories that my wife doesn't even know about. So you get the dark side of humanity in that job, brother. Let me tell you.
No, you know, I was a paramedic, so you know. I know.
Yes. Yeah. So you've seen some scenes too, but anyways, tell me, I don't even know, like, what are your dogs' names? Tell me about your dogs.
Luna and Stella.
Luna and Stella. It's so weird because I just actually wrapped up an interview with another author just now who had two dogs and one of them was named Luna.
Oh, yeah. It's a good name.
It is a good name. Yeah. Yeah.
They're good girls.
That's so great.
Yeah.
Luna. Are they rescues?
They're both rescues.
Yep.
Luna came from a house that had like 50 other dogs in it, a hoarding situation.
Okay.
Stella is a legitimate street dog.
Oh, right on. And, yep.
You know, and now they're best friends and they're both around three.
Three. Okay. So they look like medium sized ish dogs. So they got a few, lots more years to go. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something, it's great. Cause so many authors, I think just because, you know, a lot of authors live in apartments and stuff. So they're bound to the type of animal, a lot of cats,
Right. I used to have a cat. I was never a cat person, but it was a period when I had a cat. But really, I've always been a dog person. I grew up in a dog. And
I love having cats in the neighborhood for mousing reasons. But,
oh, definitely. Yeah, we have a lot of street cats around here, and I am grateful for them. Although my dogs are not, because they want to kill them. But, you know.
Yeah. I try to get down to Honduras once a year and help out, and there's dogs everywhere down there, and want to like take, and some of them are not in great shape, but it's pretty tough to leave there empty-handed, I'll tell you that. So let's do some couple of hot topics I wanted to get your thoughts on, because I'm not sure if you did it on Twitter or not, but a couple of things the last couple of weeks, right? There was some stuff going on with the Own Voices hashtag and the trigger warnings and content warnings. I don't know if you followed any of that stuff there last week.
I did.
Yeah. We Need Diverse Books has decided not to use Own Voices anymore.
Right.
What's your take on that? Not their decision, just that hashtag in general.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's... Man, that's a complicated one.
Sorry. Okay, let's talk about Star Wars.
No, we can't. Yeah. I'm not against complicated questions. It's complicated, you know.
It's not a 1 minute conversation.
I'd rather like a complicated question than like a how is it writing Star Wars? You know, like
listen, I'm not an author. I talk to them. I think, and I would think you would agree with it, in theory and concept, it was a great thing that maybe just sort of people took it and ran with it in the wrong direction, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like the ongoing problem is that, like, you know, different forms of oppression, and I think in this case, very specifically, white supremacy, are always looking to co-opt, you know, the different words that folks figure out to identify themselves or to get around or get through or have a call out for oppression. And this is an example of that. You know, that's always happening. I mean, I think I was never a big fan of the term, but I also was, I'm very aware of its necessity, right? One of the reasons it exists is because when we started talking about how we need diverse books, the publishing response was to be like, cool, we'll have white authors write diverse stories, right? Or like about characters of color. And that's not enough. That's not in itself like a terrible thing. It's not that that shouldn't exist. It's that can't be the answer to needing more diverse books. Like, we also need more diverse books by more diverse authors, right?
Right.
And so it's like, it's like every time you're like, I need this, then publishing response is like, cool, we'll do that, but in a way that doesn't actually help you. Or in a way that like is a watered down version of it or whatever it might be. And this is a perfect example of that. And so the term Own Voices came out of the need to be very specific. Like, it's not just the books, it's also the writers that need to be diverse.
Right.
And that, you know, what we've seen is that got co-opted. The issue that I've always had with it, or the sort of critique that I've always felt, is that it can also, it can be dangerous in that it can flatten things. So like, if we say this is an Own Voices book, That's probably true on one level of the identity of the author connecting to the character, but it's probably not true of all levels, right? And that's because identity is super complicated. There's intersections and there's, you know, different forms of privilege that we walk with and everything else. And I think that flattening can be very dangerous. Like, you know, people to kind of get away with things or to just like you know, just not be upfront about other stuff, or it can just overly simplify things. On the other hand, sometimes shit needs to be simple for it to get through. And that's another example of why voices took off. But then you see the co-option of it and it turning into a gatekeeping mechanism and to turned into being all the things it wasn't supposed to be. You have authors, you know, getting forced out of the closet and all kinds of other like travesties. And that's not right. You know, so I like that We Need Diverse Books moved with the times and saw how that was, how people were, how publishing was using known voices negatively and, you know, really put an end to that in their own right. And I think that's the smart thing to do. We have to be fluid and we have to be light on our feet in order to do this work, and that's hard.
Right, and it did get to a situation where it was being used to put creators in uncomfortable situations, right? And unsafe, potentially unsafe, I think We Need Divorce has even said that. And something I've talked to a lot about authors this past little while, as you know, and this is new-ish in the grand scheme of things in the history of the planet, this, you know, social media and putting yourself out there in a way that we just haven't before. And sort of the result of that is people, you know, we're demanding more of you now too, aren't we, in a way? And, you know, part of that is this protecting, I'm very protective of authors and, you know, I've seen authors get attacked for especially in an own voices situation where, like you said, it's maybe revealed something about the author they didn't want to be revealed. And a lot of that goes to, I think, this social media thing where, you know, it's you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And, you know, as someone like you, you've embraced social media and you have a ton of fun with it and your content's fantastic, but you do put yourself out there in a way, don't you? And the thing that's changed too, and please correct me if I'm wrong, there's this demand from publishers sometimes, not all the time, on the authors to do their own marketing on social media.
Right. No, that's true. Yeah, and that's bonkers, you know, but also totally like expected.
right, like, yeah. Have you ever been asked to do that by the publisher?
Actually, I haven't. I think sometimes it's unspoken and I ignore it. but I also do it already, you know, in my own way. I actually do it. So, yeah, but it is weird. It is a dynamic that plays out, and I think it's unfair. And I think a lot of authors don't necessarily realize it, that it's happening, if they're just coming into the game. You know, I also use it as a red flag. You know, like if there are stories out there of agents and publishers really like looking for having a certain follower count or whatever to pick up a client or to buy a book. And that lets you know right there that that's someone that's not going to treat your book well. That's one way to just use it. You know, like I really believe in like our own forms of gatekeeping in terms of letting people show themselves. And if that's not someone I want, in some ways, like me being outspoken is a way of doing that. If me being outspoken about, you know, different issues in the world is a problem for a publisher, that's not a publisher I'm going to work well with.
Sure.
So it kind of like is a problem that answers itself, right? Like, this is who I am. I'm going to be loud and people are going to know that. And then they're going to work with me or not. And I'll be all right. You know, having said that, that's a very privileged position to take, right? There's some people that can't afford to be choosy about their publishers. And that's a reality too. But all these things are part of it, you know. And I'm sure I've lost out on gigs for being outspoken.
Right.
And it might have been gigs that I wish I'd had. I don't know. But I know, like, I'm not going to stop being who I am, and who I am is loud.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, to that point, too, I remember Case and Calendar wrote a really great post a few months ago about, you know, I'm not going to face the fire on social media for 200 or 300 extra units sold.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
And that's, right? Like, you know, again, that's in a position where, you know, if you can afford to do that, great. But to your point, there's some people that can't, and maybe 200-300 units is a big deal, right? So
it's hard to say. Like, and then there's people that, like, sell way more than that on social media.
That's
really complicated. Like, social media can actually blow up a career.
Right.
To that, especially on TikTok recently, which is fascinating. And also,
you're the Jedi of TikTok from my...
I'm not.
I know there's people that are like they're influencers now on TikTok, but I don't know. Right. Like, I'm so shitty at it. When I see you do it, I'm like, you're fucking pretty good. I don't know.
It's like everything. I just try to have a good time. I actually haven't been doing it as much recently, but what's funny to me is that Twitter always, people on Twitter are like, you're amazing on TikTok. People on TikTok are like, who are you? You know? Because I just be out there.
There are some people that are.
But that's fine. You know, like.
Yeah.
Social media works up to the point that you're enjoying it and it's not like sucking on your creativity.
Until it doesn't work anymore.
And then you got to let it go. You know, like.
What was the, I don't even remember what it was for. Justina was on a panel recently, and she just said, like, she's like, I don't have time to argue on Twitter anymore. I'm busy. Like, I got shit to do. True. Yeah, like,
yeah. Thing, you won't really catch me arguing. There were times.
No,
were
right, days. Right, yeah.
I used to do that. Justina and I both used to do that a lot more.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about call-outs, and this is the other end of, like, just what social media has become, because there's the negative side of it, which we talked about a little bit, of people really pulling on authors in ways that aren't necessarily fair and can be actually very, like, damaging and detrimental. Right. But also, social media has given readers and writers a voice in ways that we've never had before.
Uh-huh.
And in that sense, it's like quite earth-changing and groundbreaking, and really done, like, amazing things in publishing that wouldn't have happened if it weren't. Like, a lot of the We Need Diverse Book stuff, most of it started on social media.
Right.
I know, yeah. Because I was part of that. And
yeah,
and yes, there were essays that were fundamental to that. And there were, you know, we raised our voices and continue to raise our voices in a number of ways. But those essays usually got traction because of social media. And, you know, there's always good and bad to stuff. And I don't think that makes it a wash necessarily. But I do think it's really important that, like, to pull out that part of it that, like, publishers are very aware of social media. And on the one hand, yes, sometimes that causes them to do, you know, their typical publisher bullshit of, like, you know, leaning too hard on writers. On the other hand, like, it creates another level of accountability. Right. Publishers have never been accountable to readers in anything besides sales numbers. And to a large degree, you know, their PR teams are pushing sales numbers in ways that they want, you know, which is their job, and that's what they should do. But now they're accountable to a whole other level of feedback, which is online, which I understand is terrifying to people who are used to the status quo of just being accountable to sales numbers, but the game has changed. And in a lot of ways, not all, but in a lot of ways, that has made it a more democratic community where different voices are able to get out there in ways that they never have before.
Right.
There are also problems with that in terms of people being assholes, but that's all true. You
know? Well, yeah, that's, there's like, and yeah, it's the accountability is in real time is what's changed, really, right? Like, it's instant, and it can build quick, it can blow up quickly. But yeah, as far as the, you know, the assholes, like, what was somebody said one time, like, if someone's gonna put a ladder on their toilet to stand on the top, balance on one foot to look into my window next door, you can't do anything about that person. Right? Like, that person's fucking crazy. There's nothing you can do about it, right? So focus on the other 98% of the people who aren't doing that. And the other sort of big topic last week was the trigger warnings and content warnings. I don't know if you felt
it. It's a similar thing. You know what I mean?
It's like, very similar.
It's another situation where something was came up with, you know, with the idea of compassion and humanity, and then used against specifically people of color and queer folks, you know, like in a very targeted and specific way. And it's like, all we can do, again, like, all we can do is sort of be fluid and light on our feet and figure out how to deal with stuff as it comes. But I do think that what it also means, both of these things mean that we can't afford, and we've never been able to afford, to be naive about the fact that people will use things against us that we create for our own survival. Doesn't mean we can't do those things. Like, I don't think the lesson of this is, like, no one should have come up with own voices, or we shouldn't do trigger warnings. The lesson is what it always is, that we have to be aware and on guard for this stuff and not caught off guard when it happens, you know? And I don't know what that looks like. I just know, like, that's always been the story at every, for instance, academic institution I've ever been at. There's always been some racist bullshit that goes down. And the administration, the people who are in charge, the adults, are always caught off guard and shocked by it. And the students of color are always there being like, yes, we told you this would happen. We've been telling you this would happen the whole time.
Right.
None of us are surprised that it happened. And they always go, oh my God, I'm shocked that it could happen in this wonderful community of learning. And we're all like, mother! That's because you're not listening to us.
You're not listening,
and that's also, you're not doing your job, which is also to protect us. And
safety is the number one. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that those things are all connected, you know, and I think trigger warnings are a really complicated conversation to have. And it's even harder to have it when people jump in and start using them against, you know, writers of color, like they do with so many other things. So,
I do want to kudos to Storygraph for their very quick response to that.
Yeah. It sounded like they really jumped in. I wasn't following it beat by beat, but I heard that they really were very fast. And everyone involved was like, this isn't about Storygraph. This is about people.
Right. Yeah. Them. Right. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the platform myself, but it sounds like people.
Yeah, it was, you know, supposed to be an alternative to Goodreads, right? And it's getting there. It's slowly building up and getting an audience. It's really decent. The software is fantastic. And, you know, one of the quick fixes they did for this was they just, it is real quick software fix. Like, like, okay, now there's going to be author approved content warnings, you know? So now there's two columns, right? Author approved ones and then user ones. Brilliant, right? Simple, nice. Middle grade book. I like middle grades and you know, from your perspective, from a writing perspective, is middle grade seems really great to me. You know, it's short story-ish where there's almost no fluff, right? Like you get to remove sort of all the non-relevant information in favor of character work, right? And just like go. Is that kind of how you felt doing this? Or?
No, not at all.
No.
It's different. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm just saying that's not my approach.
Right.
I respect that though. I'm trying to think of what my approach is, how to exactly explain it, but it's like, I do think of it in terms of rhythm.
Right.
And this is, you know, one thing I love about middle grade is that there are a lot of rhythms to middle grade. So I don't claim to be this is the middle grade rhythm. I just know
But what works for you? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm writing for 11-year-old me, you know, and yeah. I was already drinking, you know, Bustelo at that point. So like I was fast. I was moving fast and my mind was moving fast. Like, you know, we were caffeinated. So And I was a big Star Wars fan at 11, and I think a lot of 11-year-olds, you know, this is true for, is that like there's a lot going on. Like we think of teenagers as like the ones with all the like intense moods and everything, but that starts early. That starts before teenagers usually.
Yeah.
Again, everyone's different, but for me, like the sweet spot is like there's deep stuff going on, a little bit beneath the surface of the like fun, fast-paced adventure.
Yeah.
That's what I love in a middle grade novel. So that's what I write in a middle grade novel. So things are, you know, moving from the get-go and they're explosive and they're exciting. And there are moments to slow down and think about, like, what does it mean to be a Jedi in a world that is changing faster than I am, right?
Right.
Like, that's intense. And not for nothing, that speaks to what a lot of kids are looking at right now. This world is changing faster than it ever has in any of our lifetimes.
Right.
And they have to contend with that. They're watching it change in front of their faces and they're changing fast, but this world is changing faster. And that is incredibly intense to bear witness to and to be a part of and to experience. So to me, it feels like the High Republic is perfectly suited for this era for that very reason. And that we're talking about a time that is the best of times and the worst of times in so many ways. And, you know, so there's kids like Ram who want to just hide in their garage and like tinker with mechanical stuff and are forced to really step up into the world and deal with it in a much bigger way. And it's kids like Lula who are like, this is what I was made for. It's like times like this, like this is why I'm a Jedi, and being a Jedi is all I've ever wanted to be. So here is my moment and I will step into it, you know, gloriously.
I want to talk, rewind just a second there.
Yeah.
Because Star Wars isn't alone in this, but it's unique in the sense that just sort of going back to, you know, the way you view middle grade and how you approached it, Star Wars is different because 11-year-olds aren't reading this book predominantly, right?
I mean, I hope they are.
They will, but you know, listen, you know, you toil in Star Wars and it's going to be predominantly adults that read this book. And it's certainly going to be predominantly adults that comment on it, right? Of course, right? Just because they have the access and ability to do so. But the desire, right? 11-year-olds are great. They're going to read it and you know, love it and carry on with their day, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, and this could even be a broader Star Wars question when you're writing it. Yes, middle grade is that, you know, preteen stuff, but that's not necessarily the audience that's reading it. Right. And does that come into play at all?
Not in a way that it changed. I whether I'm writing Star Wars or my own original middle grade,
right.
It's not different in that. If you're writing middle grade, like you have to be writing to a middle grade audience.
Yeah, don't write for me. Like I'm 40, you know, like, you know, I'm not suggesting you do that at all, obviously.
But you're always aware that, yes, there's parents reading this, there's adults reading this for sure. And yeah, for me, like it's almost selfish. I'm also in my 40s, I'm 41.
Yeah.
And I want to enjoy the books I write, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm also not going to tailor it to 41-year-old me. I'm going to tailor it to 11-year-old me. I think Star Wars itself, the original trilogy, is perfect proof that like you can cross all of those ages and be totally fine.
Right? Agreed.
Like,
Yep.
it was totally age appropriate on
Yep.
any. I saw Return of the Jedi when I was 3, and I was terrified, but I was in love. You know
Yeah.
what I mean? And like,
Right.
that's the sweet spot. So like, Star Wars is made for that, and then and in no small way, it's colored my writing ever since. Like all of, like I said, all of my middle grade are like adults read it, and they're like, oh my God, you know, there's so much to devour and so much complexity and so much fun. And kids honestly say the same thing, you know, and that is the goal.
Yeah, when you can get everybody agreeing, if the baseline is that, yeah, this is just a really fun story, then you've done your job.
Exactly.
You know, and then if people are able to look, you know, for subtext or deeper meanings, then all the, you know, if they're there, I guess, you know,
right.
great, you've done your job for sure. But yeah, it's a really different, you know, Star Wars is just different, man. God, trust me, I'm with you. I saw Empire. My parents took me to see Empire when I was whatever. Like, I'm actually 45, so I've seen it all. Yeah, so I've grown up with it. So
yeah, totally.
You know, very aware that, you know, the how this thing works. And I know you do too, and all you guys do on the team, and Charles
what's
and Justine.
So cool is like, like seeing, you know, Charles and Cam's work, yep. and the stuff I'm writing for Marvel right now with the mini, with the Detective Mini. You know, that's
right.
Very adult. Like, I wouldn't give that to a kid.
Right.
If a kid picked it up, they wouldn't be traumatized necessarily.
Right.
It is very geared towards adults. So I love that there's a range to all the things, you know, that are happening.
That's a funny thing for me too, because I don't have kids and I'm not having them. So like, but I'm surrounded by them, right? Like every adult I know has kids.
Right.
And they're always asking me, like, should I take them to see this movie or that movie? And I'm like, like, it's really violent or whatever. And I'm like, well, did they see Avengers? They're like, yeah. I'm like, that's the most violent movie I've ever seen in my life. Right. Like, so I have no, you know, barometer for that type of stuff. I'm no good at that. I'm like, should my 3-year-old see Jaws? I'm like, sure. Jaws is great. Yeah. But yeah, I'll never go in the water again. But all right. Race to Crash Point Tower. What's it about?
So it's about Ramjo Muram, mostly, who lives on this planet called Valo, or Valo, depending on who you ask, where the Republic Fair is happening. So it's a sort of like a, I won't say it's a backwater planet, but it's one that doesn't get a lot of galactic attention. It's beautiful and
that's, you know, I'm going to interrupt you. That's something we see a lot of in the High Republic, which I love. Right,
yeah,
we're seeing a lot of, you know, to your words, backwater planets. You know.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, we're out there in the sort of outer rim at the
right.
time.
Yeah.
It has the Republic.
I love stretch. I love it when Star Wars stretches the map. I love that. I'm a big fan of stretching the map. I'm all for that. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. So, you know, he's not, on top of the fact that he just doesn't like being around people that much, he's also just not used to it because people don't really like flock there. Right. It's a beautiful planet with a lot of natural resources and everything, but it's just not the center of the galaxy by any means. And it's the pomp and circumstance stuff of being a Jedi is just not what he's about. He's always got grease stains on his, you know, his clothes and everything else. And he pretty much hangs out with a bunch of small furry creatures called Bombrex, and they just fix speeders together.
They're awesome.
That's
man.
What he loves doing.
Yeah.
But he quickly stumbles on what seems like a possible infiltration of the Republic Fair, and is forced to really step into himself to kind of figure out what it is, including going to jail. Spoiler.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Then we also meet Lula Tally Solo, who we know from the High Republic Adventures series, who's like the opposite in that she is just all about everything Jedi all the time, wants to be the best Jedi in the world, you know, just ambitious, which is not the most Jedi trait in the world, but she's learning how to balance all that out, and has a really cool core group of Jedi friends, some of whom are off fighting the Drengir during this time.
Mm-hmm.
And she's thrown into the middle of it too, while she's off doing her mission stuff with the Jedi, and their paths end up crossing.
It's an interesting time. So wave two, basically, you know, we've had the big event in wave one, which set this whole thing off and mm-hmm. you know, disrupted all the hyperspace lanes and you know, killed so many people.
Yeah.
So like wave two, you know, has its own sort of big event, and it's Valo, the Republic Fair, sort of, you know, won't say exactly what's going on and what happens, but this stuff reverberates through all the wave two books that I've read so far anyways. Justine is in Cavs, you know, play a big role in that, and a lot of characters are exchanged in there too. You know, one of them, like Vernestra Rowe in your book, and she's my favorite character of the High Republic so far. She's fantastic.
Okay.
You do such a great job with her, and she's just at that. It's so smart of you guys to have Vernestra be a knight at such a young age, because it's just filled with doubt and second guessing, but trust in the Force so much. And she's such a true believer. It's such a great character. But The character that I like the best in this book is Zine.
Oh, interesting. Really?
And what's interesting about the High Republic that I like a lot is kind of the Jedi at their best, right? Most influential, most powerful, certainly the most cohesive that we've seen, you know, as we've experienced Star Wars. Now, you know, this galaxy goes back, what, 45,000 years or whatever. So, you know, who knows if there was better versions of them or not. We'll find out at some point in our lives. Maybe, well, maybe not in our lifetime, but somebody might tell that story. So we've got this, the Jedi who are just like, they're so idyllic at this point, right? In the High Republic, they're so great. But at the same time, we've met people like Orla Jereni, right? A Wayseeker. We've been introduced to this concept of Wayseeking. And we have Zine. And I don't know how much we can say about Zine, but Zine's a non-Jedi who has some Force abilities. I think we're allowed to say that, right? That's an interesting concept too, isn't it? That's new. And this type of attitude, you know, that we know from characters like later on, Satine and Barriss, right? Later, much later on, this whole thing, this sort of attitude towards the Jedi, it's such an interesting thing for me. Do you guys think about that much? How you've made the Jedi so great, but then give us Wayseekers?
Right. Well, I mean, I think first of all, there's a lot of difference between someone who's a Wayseeker who's like, I'm committed to the Force.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, and I think we would agree that like if Wayseeking was still a thing or if somebody had just talked about it, it would be, you know, like Qui-Gon Jinn might be a good Wayseeker, right? Or Ahsoka would be a good Wayseeker. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And then there's someone like Zine who like really suppressed the Force because she grew up in a community that was like, that's bad. Like you're not supposed to use the Force.
Right.
Which is totally different. Right. So then she has to contend with being not of an age where she can actually become a Jedi, but you know, with these powers. So what are you supposed to do? Like, who are your people? Right. And a lot of her trajectory is that we've seen so far is really trying to figure that out and being kind of cast adrift by the one person she thought was her friend, because she's been suppressing this secret the whole time, which he considers a lie, right?
Right.
I do find her really, really fascinating as a character to write, particularly this moment that we just had in the fifth High Republic Adventures issue where she, you know, gets really in touch with her anger, let's say, right? And, yeah. You know, in regards to her friend, her ex-friend, who pretty much just cast her away and almost killed her. And then she almost kills him, right? And then I think the moment really after that is so pivotal to who the Jedi are in the High Republic era, because it would have been easy to be like, wow, you just strayed towards the dark side, like you are banished and you're nothing to us, you gotta go, which is what she expects to happen. But instead they embrace her and they pull her deeper into their ranks and they try to train her, you know, to really hone her Force abilities. And I think that's so beautiful. You know, I think that's really a moment that speaks about the compassion of the Jedi Order and their power in this era to, you know, embrace complicated situations and, you know, deal with what's not necessarily a clear cut, you know, a problem that doesn't have a clear cut answer.
Right. Well, there's a lot of lessons they haven't learned yet. Right. Lessons that we know from the main saga now, right? 300 years later, lessons they've learned, had learned the hard way. A lot of those they haven't learned yet, right? So because, you know, Anakin hasn't shown up yet, right? Or whoever. So there's a lot of stuff going on they haven't learned yet. And that's what I find really interesting too about your story in particular is, which I loved, by the way. I really enjoyed this book. Talk about, you know, 40 old white guys, you know, enjoying Daniel's middle grade book. I enjoyed it a lot. And sort of talk about sort of like getting to write, you know, we'll just say kids, children, Jedi, like, you know, right. and have it, and adults too. There are both, because your book is full of both, right? So it stars kids, but you know, you've got a mix of both in there, and talk about sort of this idea, because I mean, you know, one of the things fans always want to see, we want to see Jedi Academy stuff, right? We're always dying to see Jedi Academy stuff. And we're, you know, this isn't Jedi Academy, but it's close, right?
Right. I think it's really fun. And what to me is most exciting about it is that because it's not Jedi Academy, they're really out in the world, like with real world stuff, right? It's not Hogwarts. You know, those kids have to do real world stuff too at a different level. But yeah, they're immediately just thrust into battle and problems and tragedy and disaster and everything else. And what it does is give us so many opportunities to explore what does the Force mean? What does commitment to the Jedi Order mean for someone who is in a constant state of transition, right? Young people are always changing,
right.
Much, much faster, much more so than us oldies. And it's an important moment, you know, and young people are dealing with things first time, whether they're love, fear, you know, like all these different things, like they're much more intense because they're happening so much, you know, more suddenly out of nowhere. And you don't necessarily have the tools to deal with them. And I think it allows us to explore, like, what does that mean? Like when we talk about non-attachment in the order, like, what does that mean? What does that really mean? Does it mean you can't love, or does it mean you can't be attached? And when we separate love from attachment, I think we start to have these really fascinating conversations about what does it actually mean to love? Because we have a very certain idea in this culture of love as being very connected to attachment, and disconnecting those are a fascinating thing, right? Like the Jedi are always loving each other and things in the world, and they're also striving to be detached from it, right? And I think that's beautiful and complicated, and there's a lot to struggle with. I think fear is another really interesting topic that we get into both in the High Republic Adventures and in Race to Crash Point Tower, because fear is a normal thing to experience, and it's part of being human. And I think there's a misunderstanding that a Jedi must suppress all fear and pretend they don't feel it, when the reality is, in order to really step up into who you are, and in order to not be cowardly, in order to be courageous, you have to feel fear. You have to understand it, and you have to learn what it means to move past it again and again. And that's a very human thing. And Jedi are human, even when they're, you know, different species. And that's what we love about them, is that they're complicated and they make mistakes and they learn from those mistakes and then they make them again, right? And like, but all of that I think is accentuated by them being young.
Right.
And from having to really like grow up in this and understand what it means in battle and in disaster, and make these decisions that matter to the galaxy.
Right. But also, like I said, the consequence part, fear isn't the boogeyman yet, is it? Right.
Right. They're not Jedi that are honed in battle yet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Too, right? Right. All the Jedi we meet in the prequel trilogy have lived through war from most
right.
of their lives.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
been the constant state. And these kids, that's not true for them. They grew up in peace, and they're seeing war now for the first time, most of them. And that's right. a very different reality.
Because not so much in your book, but in a couple of the other ones, they mentioned some characters who have been around a long time, right? So, right. and you know, and they would have a different, you know, I mean, just it'd be interesting. Oh, yeah. Their point of view of someone who's experienced it all, right, is going to be a tremendous.
Yeah, we see that a little more in the, there's an upcoming run of the High Republic Adventures. Actually, the next two issues deal with Barzala and his master,
right.
who's been around for about 1,000 years.
Right.
And he's had numerous Padawans become knights and die. And, you know, then just his, that's a different life than mm-hmm. than the most of the ones we've met, you know, and all that. So there's a lot of exciting kind of conversing with that, those ideas up ahead.
One thing too, I like that very much. It's your book and in Justina's too, Out of Shadows, a lot more. This attraction to each other comes up a lot, and it's great because it's like that elephant in the room that, I mean, again, goes back to the just your point about being human, humanity, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's we know it's there. It's like, you know, when we watch a movie and you're like, how come no one goes to the bathroom? You're like, you know they're going to the bathroom,
right.
but they're just not showing it. So now it's like you guys are showing us the bathroom. It's really great in a way, or the refresher, I guess they call it in Star Wars. You know, it's so wonderful that you guys are giving that to us finally. And it's so great that it's through the lens of younger Jedi, and it's so great and so wonderful, and I'm enjoying it so much. And you know, you guys, one thing I said to, I was talking to Justina about Ophi's ghosts, which is so great. You know, this, I mean, fuck you again, 40 years, right? We've been doing this shit.
Right.
We now finally have an answer to the question. You know, you probably get it way more than I do. I'm new to Star Wars. Where should I start reading? Right? And you can finally say The High Republic.
You know,
from scratch, right? There's, of course, exactly. some of the phase one, you guys refer back to a couple of events that took place long before, but right. it's about as fresh start as you're going to get. And yeah. it's perfect. And I just like that to me is worth it, was worth all the money, you know, Disney's oh. spending on it alone.
Yeah.
I think it's, no,
it's wild to realize that like young people, especially with this comic series, like young people are really discovering Star Wars through this series for the first time, right? Like meeting Yoda and like, you know, there's so much Yoda ahead for them to.
Yeah. Right.
Power. And it's really, yeah, it's really thrilling to be part of it.
Cause I mean, listen, I adored Last Shot, but I would never tell someone to start there. Right. Like you just can't. Right. So you would have, you know, as long as you find your way through all of it, buy it all is what we're saying. But if you really want to start, you know, High Republic, man, that's such a, one of the things that occurred to me. I'm just like, that's so great. I don't want to keep you much longer because I know you're doing me a favor here. So I'm going to pull a Seglane on you and ask you a Seglane. Normally, because we've been deprived of our panels, right? The last year. So we haven't had these great publishing panels. I mean, we're coming back this year, it looks like, but we'll see how much we get from there. But
yeah.
So here's a Seglane, and I know you'll recognize as soon as I say it. Give me somebody that you'd love to tackle, take a pass at. And also, are you or do you want to go back to the old timeline, to the Skywalker stuff? Like, do you think there's, you know, is that?
This one's out in the world. I'm doing a one shot that's part of the War of the Bounty Hunters.
Right. Okay. Oh, sorry. I'm so like book orientated, oh, no, right? I don't even think.
Yeah. It's a lot of information out there. Trust me.
Yeah.
So no, I definitely love the original trilogy and the whole timeline.
Because that's getting crowded now, right? We got a lot of stuff in that timeline, and
but there's always room.
Of course. Well, there's billions of planets. There's always stories to tell. So
definitely. Yeah. Definitely. But in terms of who, you know, I don't know. It's so weird to be this. I feel very spoiled as a star.
Yeah, yeah.
I really get to like do.
Because Justina always says Mace, right?
Oh, yeah. Justina loves
Mace. Must do a Mace Windu, yeah.
I understand. I love Mace too. I really don't have one that I'm like, I can't believe I haven't gotten to ride. I'm really enjoying having created all these original characters.
You're doing, yeah. I mean, you're spoiled. Like you said, you're so spoiled right now, I guess. Cool. But like, the funny thing about Mace was we were talking to her about it, and she's like, I'm like, it's completely feasible because, first of all, the Darth Maul thing is just open the doors for any death now. But, but you know, that's a classic film thing too, right? If you don't see them die, they didn't. Okay. Right? So,
you know, what I will say is like, it's so funny because I have a real soft spot for the underworld stuff.
Yeah.
Across the board. I just really love, it's really funny because recently I've been realizing there's a why behind some of that. And I was just like, yeah, I just love gangster movies. But like, I don't know if you've watched this show, City on a Hill.
No, I haven't. No.
It's about Boston gangster stuff.
Okay. I've seen the commercials for it. Yeah, I haven't seen it.
It's a great show. I'm most of the way through the first season. Kevin Bacon is astonishing. Aldis Hodge. So good. Anyway, it's like really about like the place and time that I grew up and literally my neighborhood, Charlestown, where I grew up in the part of Boston I grew up in, like, and I knew this growing up, like it's literally like the bank robber capital of the English speaking world.
Okay.
Particularly at that, in those years, the 80s and the 90s.
Okay.
And like, that was all around me. Like it was a very real thing. Like I didn't grow up like in the thick of that, but I grew up in the heart of it, you know, in different ways. And like, I just really do love gangster stories. I don't know if that's why exactly, but I have a soft spot for it, especially in Star Wars. Return of the Jedi, you know, the Jabba sequence is like really what I call home for me. Like that's the beginning of it all. That's really what I love the most about that movie. And it's basically flawless as far as I'm concerned. And so much of my own storytelling goes back to that, just that opening sequence, you know? And so,
you know what's funny? You know the thing that comes up about that scene is people sort of like that are negative about it, say it doesn't make any sense. The plan didn't work. What was the plan? I've got it. I've busted that. Like the theory, the plan was if you just go all in on that, the plan was just to get Jabba out of the palace.
Yeah, draw him out. Yeah.
That's it. Everything else makes sense, right?
Totally. Yeah. Also, I'm totally fine with it not making sense. Like, it's good enough that I don't actually care whether or not.
It doesn't matter to me.
But yeah, either way, right. So I've always wanted to do more, you know, just criminal stuff.
Sure.
But then I can't say Fuala Manzucas were on my like bucket list to write.
Right.
So when I wrote them for the Empire thing, I was still really for the From a Certain Point of View anthology. Like, I had a great time writing that story, but you'll notice, like, I came at them from a whole other character's point of view.
Right.
I just hadn't cracked the code of how to do it, but I feel like I really did with the Marvel, like, on my second go around, like, really figure out how to write for Alan Mazzucchis. And some of the answer to that actually showed up in the Bounty Hunters, the War of the Bounty Hunters issue that just dropped.
Okay.
It sets up, I won't spoil it, but it really does set up where we now find our heroes being these two insectile bounty hunters, right? And like that, something about it like really cracked the code for me, and I was like, oh, I totally know how to write them now. And again, I'm really proud of the short story and from a certain point of view, but like the driving force of that story is not for Lama Tuckus. They're kind of they're part of it, they're a big part of it, but it's really more about this guy doing this puff piece gone wrong.
But that goes in line with what the premise of that book
exactly.
Right, you, yeah, that makes more sense.
This was just a whole other experience writing them for this Marvel one shot, and I'm really glad I got the chance to like try again and figure it out, because I really do feel like I figured it out. So
right, there's that. Those certain point of view books are so great, because they really just, like, if you had any doubt about how like deep these things are, you know what I mean? Like
it's my origin story, you know.
Right, right.
My story was Sardis Ramson, you know, being obsessed with Dubaks, and that's autobiographical. I was obsessed with Dubaks. We didn't know what they were called. I didn't know
what they were called.
Yeah. I think we had the toy, but we probably threw away the box. And I don't remember what it said on the box. You know, like, I think I found out they were called Dubaks when I was an adult. But I was just like, there's a huge creature and we barely get to see it. Like, that alone is so enticing for me. For my young mind, I was just like, there must be so many gigantic, amazing things in this world that we haven't even glimpsed yet. And I was right. And Dubaks kind of symbolized that. And I was obsessed with them. I was like, they're just the coolest thing ever. Like, people ride them the way we ride horses, but they're lizards, like, amazing.
Even the Krat dragon skeleton, right? Like, remember seeing that as a kid, and you're like,
think you'd see the real thing?
What is that? Yeah. Daniel, I can't thank you enough, man. I really appreciate it. I know you're writing and in between other things, and you're squeezing all these interviews in. So I really appreciate the time. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time.
Yeah, it was fun. I'm glad we did it.
So thank you so much. I don't think I need to tell anybody that these books are coming out and how to get them and where to get them. But and I know I won't ask you if you're part of phase two, because you wouldn't answer me anyways. But we'll see if they give a new crop, a new Fabulous Five or a new Luminous Five get a shot at phase two or not. We'll find out. Again, though, just to circle back, I am so thrilled with the amount of material we're getting in each phase. It's so incredible. Yeah,
it's so really fun. It's really fun to write, and it's really fun to read.
Well, I'm the proof is in the pudding. If there's any doubt about, they picked the right five people, I think they kicked this thing off, and then, you know, whether we'll see what happens next. But thank you so much, Daniel. Enjoy the rest of your day.
There you have it, another episode of Everything is Canon all wrapped up. Huge thanks to Daniel for coming on the show. It's been a long time coming, and I'm thankful he took the time from his busy schedule. Listen, it takes very little effort to get your hands on these Star Wars books these days, thanks to the Disney machine, and Wave 2 is for sale now. So check them out and buy them wherever you buy your books. Head on over to danieljoseolder.net to find out all you need to know about what he's got going on. As always, be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you choose to listen, and head on over to cinelinks.com for the latest movie, TV, books, and gaming news. Please continue to be safe out there. Bye for now.